This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in an imaginary chamber strewn with charts and decorated with screens into which the top experts on the big questions of the day arrive to tell us what we need to know in 28 minutes. That's The Briefing Room. Today we're using a conceit that I'm in turn each of the main political party leaders seeking expert advice on how to handle the general election that seems likely to take place before too long. Who have I got to appeal to and how? Find out here. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy some of our other episodes, including last week's hour-long special, The Perfect Storm, The United Kingdom, Brexit and its History. You can find it on BBC Sounds. What am I? Nobody really wants me, but everyone says they do, and the pundits say I'm inevitable and possibly imminent. I am, of course, the next general election. But if there were such an election any time soon, what should be the winning strategies of the main party leaders? Indeed, what would winning even look like to some of them? For this edition of The Briefing Room, I've decamped to a smoky backroom in Westminster to find out. Let's start by having a fast drone ride over the electoral landscape to see where the political parties stand at the moment. Earlier, I was joined in the briefing room by David Cowling, political analyst and expert in voting patterns. David Cowling, let's start with the polling position of the parties. How are they doing?
Well, both Labour and the Conservatives are down more than 10 points on where they were in 2017. The Conservatives in the low 30s, Labour in the mid-20s. The Lib Dems, on the other hand, have jumped about 10 points from 2017. So it's been a very substantial change from 2 years ago.
Is this roughly what we might have anticipated would have happened after a change of Conservative leadership?
I don't believe so at all. I mean, past historical record doesn't suggest that there would be this sudden explosion that turns all the tables of polling to looking like Spaghetti Junction, where parties going all over the place. I've not seen that in my lifetime in quite such a fashion, so I don't think it is expected. I think it may be something deeper running underneath this, I think, than just simply, oh, it's a bit different from what it was in the past.
So this something presumably being a loss of party affiliation to the two main parties, a greater voter volatility. How far is it also because we have the dominance of this huge, great issue, Brexit?
I think it's in large measure due to that, and I think it is the fact that for many people, whichever side they take in that big debate, are exasperated by the political class generally as a group. They've had 3 years to sort this, and it hasn't appeared to be sorted, and we are now up against the brink. So a lot of the volatility, a lot of the anger that seems to me to be bubbling under the surface comes from people who expected this to be sorted, and it hasn't been.
Are these the sorts of circumstances at which in individual seats, if we take seats individually, independents, independent conservatives, what we traditionally call third parties, tend to do better and actually determine outcomes?
I think given the present polling position of the parties, if that carried through to a general election, that's a big if, but if it did, then all bets are off in a way. We will be entering into an election with the distribution of our polling very familiar to people who live on the continent who carry on with proportion representation. But these figures will have to be fed into our very brutal first-past-the-post system. And we've had examples in the past where you can get very, very big votes and no consequences, no seats. If you pile up lots and lots of votes and get second in loads and loads of places, that's very nice, but you don't win any prizes. UKIP in 2015 got 3.9 million votes in that general election and got one member of parliament.
Does it also mean, paradoxically, that you could conceivably win an overall majority on an extraordinarily low percentage of the overall vote?
Well, I remember we looked back in 2005 for that election result where Labour won a majority of about 66 with 35% of the vote. And the uproar that followed that election was absolutely disgraceful. Democratic outrage. Now, 35%, people will be giving themselves Olympic medals if they get anywhere near 35%.
It makes us sound like the two Yorkshiremen. 35%? We used to dream of 35%.
Amen to that.
David Cowling. So the overall picture, it's messy and volatile. So what should the party leaders do? With the help of two gender reassignments and several personality transplants, I'm going to step into the shoes of each of them in turn and get headline advice from Rosie Campbell, Professor of Politics at King's College London, and Rob Ford, Professor of Political Science at the University of Manchester. Let's begin with Boris Johnson.
Yet I have accepted the reality that an election is the only way to break the deadlock in the House and to serve the national interest.
OK, I'm Boris Johnson. Rob Ward, what's my immediate objective?
Well, your immediate objective is to try and get to Election Day with a similar polling position to the one that you have when the election is called, which is the Conservatives with a moderate lead. But your immediate problem is that you've had to ask for an extension, and one of the groups of voters that you've won over since May, which is the Brexit Party voters, will be very, very annoyed about that. So you've got to try and stop the leakage of Brexit Party voters and try and convince them that the only way they're going to get the kind of Brexit they want is to vote for you. But you're also facing a second problem on the other flank of the Brexit issue, which is you've also got to try and minimise the leakage of very strongly Remain voters to the Liberal Democrats. Your end objective is, of course, some sort of a workable majority so you can actually get stuff passed, unlike your predecessor, and that requires net gains. So the really difficult thing is trying to stop leakage in two directions at once. Not easy.
Rosie.
I don't know if I buy that's your objection, given you're Boris Johnson. You're a slightly atypical politician who decides which side you're on the referendum campaign by writing two different articles for either side. Is your objective the straightforward politician wanting to get a secure, nice, slim majority and be able to govern? Or would you rather take a big gamble, take a risk, and become king of the world, or more likely, Prime Minister of England after Scotland's left? And I think if you're that kind of character, then actually doing something much more risky, really considering the deal with Nigel Farage, maybe really considering no deal as a serious option, it's, you know, you're the kind of risk taker that might just do that because you think the gains might be significant enough.
I'm Johnson, the risk taker for the time being. How do I do the thing that you suggest?
You count on the fact you don't need to look to your left flank, that the Remain, the left of centre vote is just so divided that if you can pull the Brexit vote together with a really hard line, aggressive populist message, you might just do it. You might just get even possibly a 40-seat majority if he could pull that off.
What do you think of that prospect, Rob Ford?
Well, I think it's a risk-taking prospect. It's a roll of the dice. And the reason it's a big roll of the dice is because we've seen a Prime Minister try exactly that strategy before in 2017, and it came a cropper. And the reason it came a cropper was because the kind of voters you're going for, who are very Brexity but traditionally don't vote Conservative, they don't feel the same about Leave and about Brexit as they feel about the Conservative Party. And the big risk you take is you go all in to try and win them over, and they say to you, sorry, mate, I can never vote for the Conservatives. So you don't gain the seats that you're going for, but you still lose the ones on the other flank. So you end up in potentially the same position as before, or in an even worse position. That's the gamble.
Let's suppose I'm not Johnson, the risk taker. I'm Johnson, the maximiser. I've got to try and maximise my position from the existing votes and the existing seats. I'm not going to risk too much. Who am I trying to win under those circumstances?
You're basically playing a game of who loses least. Because both parties are down quite a lot on 2017. They're likely to stay down, I think, through to the election. And the winner will be whoever holds on to as much of the 2017 vote as possible. And so what you're hoping is that Corbyn loses a whole heap of votes to the Lib Dems. And if you just stay in place, that's really good for you. You can win a whole bunch of seats. So that's what you're trying to do. Try and hold on to your Tory Remainers, so you mend fences with your Nicola Soameses and your Philip Hammonds, and you try and push as hard a Brexit message as possible, but not so hard that that you threaten and alienate those voters and try and keep the Brexit Party vote down as much as possible by holding on to those guys you already won in 2017 with a Brexit message and hope that Labour goes down.
Now, I can see I've got one or two problems with that strategy, Rolfe, because I'm looking at a problem in Scotland, for instance, which means that I could lose a number of seats. And I know that because of the stance I've already taken, which is quite hard on Brexit, there are a number of southern seats and maybe even West Country seats which are at risk. So where, if I'm going to keep at a relatively steady state and just improve on it, where am I looking to win?
Well, in this situation, you're learning potentially a slightly unusual lesson from Donald Trump. One of the things about Trump's election was he won in part because of who he wasn't rather than who he was. So he managed to get back all of those never-Trumpers, those reluctant Republicans, because they really, really couldn't stand Hillary and were really threatened by what they thought Hillary would do to the Supreme Court, for example. So what you do is you say, look, I know you don't like me and I know you don't like Brexit, but look at that guy. You can't allow that guy in. And that can work in both Scotland and the South East, because actually the Ruth Davidson thing in Scotland was important, but actually when you look at the kind of voters the Conservatives won in 2017, they're often socially conservative unionists who really dislike independence. So you go very hard against independence in Scotland and you go very hard against Corbyn in England and sort of turtle up, as it were, and say, look, guys, you may not like me for what I'm for, but think about what the alternative is, way worse.
Rosie Campbell, you're nodding.
I absolutely agree. I think that's where all of Boris Johnson's room for manoeuvre comes from, is how relatively unpopular Jeremy Corbyn is.
So much for Boris Johnson. Next, pint and fag in hand, let's assume I'm Nigel Farage of the Brexit Party.
If, Mr. Johnson, you insist on the withdrawal agreement, we will fight you in every single seat up and down the length and breadth of the United Kingdom.
Here I am, Nigel Farage. What's my immediate objective, Rosie?
OK, well, I mean, you're in an absolute win-win situation, aren't you? You can say that you've reached out your hand to Boris and offered to cooperate, and if he doesn't, any mess that ensues from following Brexit is Boris's fault. If he does cooperate with you, then you can go back into retirement again and spend more time down the pub. So I'm really not sure you're in much need of my advice.
Rolfe, you know me a little bit. Do I want to retire or do I want a long-term political career based on a significant performance by the Brexit Party?
I think, Nigel, that you love the fray of politics, so I don't think you're going anywhere anytime soon. And I think the question I'd be asking to you, is it really about Brexit, Nigel? If you really, really want Brexit, then you're going to need to think about standing down candidates for seats that are held by, for example, members of the ERG Spartans, because they're going to vote your way. So why harm their prospects? You might want to think about standing.
Those are the Tory hard Brexiteers, yes. For the people who are not familiar with the new terminology.
Yes, who've described themselves as like the Spartans. They'll fight to the last man and so forth. So you want them in Parliament. They're on your side, essentially. And if there are candidates in marginal seats who are similar, you also want them on your side. So if you really want Brexit done, it's probably going to have to get done via the Conservative Party.
But it's been put to me that the one thing actually I could do if I put in a pretty good performance and I actually campaign hard and effectively is that I could actually let Jeremy Corbyn, or heaven forfend, give the Liberal Democrats the balance of power in a hung parliament.
I think you might not be too worried about that, in that then in future elections the Brexit Party is still going strong and can influence things. But perhaps I'm wrong, perhaps I'm being too cynical about you.
Well, I think, Nigel, that if you're like St. Augustine, you want Brexit to happen at some point, but maybe not exactly yet, that's a great scenario for you, because Brexit fails, Jeremy Corbyn gets in, your kind of voters really hate him, that's great for growing your support, the Conservatives have failed on Brexit, so you can start perhaps longer-term process of a hostile takeover of the Conservative Party, start targeting seats and actually becoming a serious force in Parliament. So it's not necessarily bad for you.
Well, OK, so the picture you painted there is Farage the Matteo Salvini, the Italian populist, or something like that, who actually doesn't just want Brexit, but actually sees a new form of populist, what's often called ethno-nationalist politics. Should I be tempted down that route?
Well, there are a number of reasons to think it's a route worth thinking about. We know that Brexit identities out there in the electorate are stronger than traditional party identities, which means there's a great big chunk of the electorate that feels really, really strongly that Leave is who they are, heart and soul. And you speak to those voters probably as effectively as anybody in politics. So there's a really unusual opportunity to realign a big chunk of the electorate behind a new party. Those kind of opportunities don't come along every day, Nigel, so you may want to think about it.
Rosie Campbell, I think my Nigel Farage is going to go along with that. I've got people behind me who say, yes, the time is right for realignment of politics and the creation of a populist force on the right and so on. How, in that case, given that I now want to maximise my vote, do I treat Boris Johnson? How am I going to describe him? Am I going to describe him as a failure?
Secret Remainer.
A secret Remainer. Now I'm assuming the Marks and Sparks bought mantle of the leader of the Labour Party.
A general election is coming. But we won't allow Johnson to dictate the terms. And I can tell you this, we're ready for that election.
Rob Ford, what, as Jeremy Corbyn, am I looking to do?
Well, you've got a difficult decision in front of you, really, because we're in a situation where Brexit's been delayed. It's still hanging over us as we go into the election. And there are two ways that Labour could go with that. One is to sort of do the inverse of the Boris strategy in terms of being about what you're against rather than what you're for. Remain voters really, really, really dislike no deal and are very afraid of it. And if you go very hard on that, perhaps you can bring back together the kind of coalition that you got in 2017 and you get to win the backwards race. But it's not certain to work, so you may want to think about the other strategy, which probably fits with your kind of political instincts, and say, well, actually, a lot of voters are just sick and tired of talking about Brexit anyway, so let's run on talking about the NHS, on talking about security, on talking about public services, on austerity, because it worked really well for us in 2017. Bring back your voters in that way.
Rosie Campbell, I can scarcely be satisfied with my polling levels at the moment. What am I going to do to boost them?
Well, can I first ask whether your advisers might just step out of the room so we could speak privately?
Okay.
Because right, I think we're more likely to make some progress if you can really be independent and think this through yourself. Because I know you're really ideologically committed to seeing a left Labour government in office. You're looking at those figures. We both know that if you were just to step down and there would be a Labour leadership election, another candidate of the left would be elected and they would have much more of a chance of winning this election.
I'm not tempted by that. We'll talk about other strategies in a moment. Rob, whose votes am I looking to get? Am I just looking to keep the votes that I got last time?
Well, that's the backwards race thing again. Both parties are likely to go backwards. So voters you need to get back who've departed since 2017 fall into two camps. They're the ones who are going over to the Brexit Party, and then there's the ones who are going over to the Lib Dems. And you've got the mirror image of Boris Johnson's problem, which is that anything that appeals strongly to one of those two groups alienates the other one. So you've got to make a really tough choice about which set of those voters matter most.
Rosie Campbell, I'm going to forgive you for your earlier suggestion, Act of Les Majestate, and ask you which of those choices I should make.
I'm not sure whether it is such a terrible idea to rerun the strategy that was successful, well, relative to expectations in the last election, in that I think you're facing a different candidate, a polarising candidate. You know, Boris Johnson isn't Theresa May. He's not a kind of liberal conservative candidate in the mould that he's in at the moment. We had this image of the Spartans, this very aggressive, macho kind of politics. I actually think if you can be a little bit more cohesive, if you can pull together women, younger voters, last time under 45, maybe this time under 50, ethnic minorities, if you can be seen to be the grown-up in the room, pull people from the centre of the Labour Party into your orbit, you could really break through.
Now, the strategy you're outlining would work better if I were strongly Remain, wouldn't it?
You don't want to lose the Brexit-supporting Labour voters either. And so I think in some ways, if you could surround yourself by Remainers, be committed to a second referendum, but not say which way you would campaign in that, I'm not sure it's such a terrible strategy.
Rob Ford.
Well, I think a second referendum probably gets you a long way. And perhaps what you need is a kind of bifurcated campaign. So down in the sort of southern suburbs and so forth, with the kind of voters that Rose is talking about, you run strongly about Remain and also about this broader liberalism that you can paint Boris and the Spartans as potentially threatening. Ethnic minority voters potentially very key with that long-standing distrust with the Conservatives. And indeed, one of the seats that could fall that's very diverse is Boris Johnson's own seat of Uxbridge. It's one of the most diverse seats in the the country that's still held by a Conservative. So that might be a seat to focus on for exactly that reason. Then in the North, maybe you don't talk about Brexit so much and just really amp up the "you can never trust the Tories" type message. Because what we know about these Labour leavers is two things. They really, really like Brexit, very, very suspicious of the Conservatives, because that's sort of embedded in the culture of those places.
So what should my campaign top line be, do you think?
I was trying to think about this. And what about, I don't know, vote Labour for the common good? Something about bringing everybody together with a tiny little bit of a Marxist flavour.
Tiny Marxist flavour?
Vote Labour for a fresh start. End to austerity, end to Tory rule, new referendum, turn the page.
Jeremy Corbyn there. A twirl in the phone box, and I'm Joe Swinson, recently elected leader of the Liberal Democrats.
We will stand to secure a Liberal Democrat majority. Such a Liberal Democrat majority government would indeed revoke Article 50. I do not think
Rosie, I'm Joe Swinson, and I'm quite excited.
Well, I'm glad you're excited, Joe. Would you like some of my advice?
I think I would, excited though I am.
Well, I think, you know, you obviously things are going well for you relative to where the Liberal Democrats were. I think one of your biggest challenges is going to be you're going to need some kind of electoral alliances, but Labour are probably not going to play ball. So how are you going to maximise your votes where you need them? And I think you should go out with a very simple message. In Conservative seats, find out which party came second last time and vote for them, because I think that will do you enough good targeting vote in the seats that you need. It's a risky strategy, but it's a simple message.
My advice would probably be similar to Rose's. One of the mistakes they made, I think, in 2010 with Cleggmania. You remember that? Hard to believe, but at one point, Nick Clegg polled better than Winston Churchill in one poll. And there's a chance that Jo Swinson may end up with a big campaign boost as well. She's a fresh face. She's not well known by the electorate, who don't particularly like the two mainstream party offers. That's exactly the position Nick Clegg was in 2010. So she'd get a big boost in the campaign. Then the Lib Dems lost their heads and campaigned too broadly and ended up with fewer seats than they had in the previous election. So I think what you need to be saying to your activists is, no, we need to keep our eyes on the prize here and focus on the seats where we're already second place, because those seats, we can squeeze the vote and win.
So, Rosie Campbell, how ecumenical am I going to be? In other words, how much am I going to reach out to other parties or support other parties in order to win seats from the two main parties?
Well, your party really tried to last time, but I'm afraid the only real electoral pacts that existed were between yourselves and the Greens, and I think it would make sense to do that again, because the Greens really need to be able to concentrate their votes in a small number of seats, and their vote is spread very thinly across the country. So I certainly think that you need to cooperate with the Greens in that way.
What about Plaid Cymru in Wales?
Yeah, I think that a similar strategy could work quite well for the Liberal Democrats with Plaid. It could be mutually beneficial because the geography of their vote is quite different. So there's a number of seats in Wales where the Lib Dems have a good chance, but Plaid votes are normally pretty weak. And then there's some seats, particularly in sort of west and north of Wales, where Plaid are traditionally very strong, but they would certainly benefit from the boost of having a Lib Dem candidate stand aside. So it would certainly make sense to go looking for it.
Now, I'm going to be asked, because Liberal Democrat leaders always are, who I would make form a government with and who I would support. What should I say?
I think this is actually quite a simple one. With Boris Johnson, we're taking a very hard Brexit position, that you would sign up with any of the parties that are interested in a second referendum and not with those that are not.
That would mean that you'd have to sign up for the possibility of supporting Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. And some of your more recently arrived members from Labour have joined you precisely because they didn't want to do that.
Haven't you been equivocating a bit on that lately? I know you were very, very strongly against having Jeremy Corbyn even as an interim Prime Minister, but in this very dire situation where, from your point of view, a no-deal Brexit is on the horizon, isn't this something you might need to consider?
I think there's a relatively simple message to pursue on this. Whether it works is difficult, but it's pretty obvious given the kind of voters you're attracting. They're strongly tribal Remainers. You say, I will do whatever I need to do in Parliament to advance the Remain cause. Ideally, staying in altogether. If not, then a second referendum, and say, this is a national emergency. All the other issues are secondary to that. I'm not going to get into discussions about who we do a deal with after that, because let's get this Brexit emergency out of the way. And I would use that kind of very strong language about it, because then you just punt the whole thing into the background in a way that actually works for the kind of voters that you're appealing to anyway.
So much for Joe Swinson. Finally, let's turn to the Scottish National Party's Nicola Sturgeon.
So I relish the prospect of a general election. I really relish the prospect. of a general election.
Rob, it's not complicated for me, is it?
Actually, it's a bit more complicated than it looks, because in 2017, the SNP's vote went down a lot, and obviously we know the Conservatives won a bunch of seats there, and that was partly because the SNP pushed very hard for a second referendum soon after Brexit, and they failed to realise, I think, or you failed to realise, Nicola, that there are actually two kinds of independence-leaning Scottish voters. There's the ones who want a progressive Scotland and think that a right-wing England holds them back, and there's ones that just don't like being ruled by foreigners, don't like being ruled by the English, don't like being ruled by Brussels either, and that's second kind of Scottish nationalist independence-leaning voter was really alienated by your decision to immediately call for a second referendum explicitly in order to stay in the EU, and they went over to the Conservatives in large numbers, cost you a number of seats. And right now, nearly all of your seats, Nicola, in Scotland are marginal because your vote's very evenly spread. So I think you want to be very careful what you say about a second independence referendum in case you antagonise more of those voters and end up getting a similar share of the vote, but maybe losing a bunch of seats unexpectedly, because expectations for you were very high.
I thought, Rosie Campbell, that all I had to do was to say I'm the only person acting in Scotland's interests and the others don't.
I think it's easier for you to do that now that Ruth Davidson's gone, who was, you know, seen as a very moderate Conservative and appealing to a broad base. I also think having Boris Johnson as the Prime Minister helps you too. I think with some of the voters you're describing, having an old Etonian back in office. So I think to some extent, I agree with Rob's analysis, but I also think a lot of time has passed since the referendum, so and the prospect of no deal is seriously on the table. And so actually, I think you've got a little bit more room to compromise there than you did have previously.
Right, well, I think as Nicola, I've heard all I need to for the time being. So now I'm going to revert to being the presenter of The Briefing Room.
And nice to have you back, David.
Oh, thank you very much. And one last question to both of you, and actually you won't be so glad when you hear what it is, because it's a kind of hand grenade lobbed into this discussion. How much does all of the things that we've been discussing change if by the time of the next election we do somehow have a deal and the UK has exited or is about to exit the European Union? Rob?
Well, I think if Boris has a deal, the big advantage of that will be a lot of Brexit voters, all they will hear, the quite low information voters, many of them not paying attention to the day-to-day, is we're out and we've got a deal. And if you're Boris, that's what you'll run out constantly. I'm the one that took us out. We're out. We're free. Hurrah. And so that will be what you run on. The risk for you with this hand grenade situation is that what if the voters then say, OK, well, that's done, so let's go back to talking about the other issues, at which point you're then potentially very open to a Labour campaign that's focused on a decade of Tory austerity and public services and stuff like that.
So you're actually making me think that Boris Johnson might have as much in common with Churchill as he thinks he has. In that he might actually find that he wins the war and then comes
loses
back
the
and
peace,
the
yes,
yeah. Indeed.
People don't want him. What impact might it have upon the other parties? I presume that if I step back into Jeremy Corbyn, it's absolutely straightforward for me now. I just say, this new Britain outside the European Union, give me the chance to change it and transform it.
I mean, I think in the short term, you see you enormous sigh of relief, because actually this issue that you perhaps are not aligned with a lot of your members on is dissipated. But we should return to one of Rob's earlier comments, that Brexit identity, be it Remain or Leave, has become firmly entrenched. And I don't think just because we leave the European Union, this debate is going away. Sorry, Jeremy.
Now, I'm Joe Swinson, and I'm also Nicola Sturgeon in the same breath, Rob Ford. There's now a deal. Scotland is coming out of the European Union with everybody else, if I'm Nicola Sturgeon, or if I'm Joe Swinson. We're out of the EU. Do I can't begin the campaign to come back in again?
Well, you look to ride the wave of Remainer anger about the fact that we're now out of the EU, and you say this is unacceptable and we need it reversed. And if you're Joe Swinson, your big hope is that the main thing that's been propping Jeremy Corbyn up, because his personal ratings are really terrible, is the argument that you've got to vote for him because it's the only way to stop the Tories doing Brexit. Well, they've done Brexit now, so there's no reason left. So come over to us. Come over to the party that actually sort of backs what you believe in. And so you essentially look to rip a huge chunk of the Labour vote out from under them, because their core Brexit argument is gone.
Rob Ford there, and my thanks to David Cowling and Rosie Campbell. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ruth Alexander, Neil Koenig and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.